Welcome to Inside Track. Santa Aurelia LLC is solely responsible for its content. The views and opinions expressed on Inside Track are those of the host and guests, and not necessarily endorsed by KVOI or its advertisers, but they should be. And now, here's Bruce Ash.
Hello, Insiders, and a very pleasant good afternoon to you wherever you may be. This is your host, Bruce Ash, going solo again today, welcoming you to a special edition of Inside Track. I'll speak with retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Peter Gerritsen about America's blueprint for an ambitious new space program and deep space exploration. After the break, we'll turn attention to Trump 2020 Strategic Coalition's advisor Boris Epstein on how President Trump has helped save our American suburbs. We again have another great show for you today on Inside Track. As always, thank you so much for supporting our great Inside Track sponsors, Jamie and Gary Kipper from Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus, Gary Imus and my co-host Eb Wilkinson with Imus Wilkinson Asset Management, and those kids from Corazon Cabinets, Joy, Allie, and David. These are great local companies you should do business with. I do. You should too. Do you have a home improvement project you want to start this summer, but are worried if you can afford the luxury you deserve? Corazon Cabinet sells quality J&K, Conestoga, Yorktown, and Waypoint cabinets. Plus, Corazon Cabinets offers professional design services for your home. Call Corazon Cabinets at 488-2266 and schedule a visit to the showroom. It's an easy number to remember, 488-2266. Tell Joy, Allie, or David you heard this ad with Bruce on Inside Track and get an additional 5% discount on their already low wholesale prices. Okay, on a bit of local news, we've just completed the Arizona primary earlier this week, and there have been a couple of surprises and lots of great Republican candidates who will face off in the November general election. It seemed to me the biggest upset of the evening was Dr. Matt Hines' defeat of longtime Democrat supervisor Ramon Valadez, as well as Brandon Martin getting the nomination in CD2 over Eric Rudin. Steve Spain won a four-way Pima Soups number one race, which shows the influence of outgoing supervisor Allie Miller. If Allie wants a future in politics, she certainly has a lot of horsepower to do so, starting in the 22 cycle. The biggest winner, though, for the evening was Senator Martha McSally's overwhelming win over Demand Daniel McCarthy for the U.S. Senate nomination. It's time for Republicans to unite around our candidates up and down the ballot. Our guest for the next several minutes is a retired Lieutenant Colonel Peter Gerritsen, an independent strategy consultant who focuses on space and defense issues. He has and does serve on many groups advocating for our country's future in space research, plus space and planetary defense. He just wrote an opinion piece for Newsweek, which I caught and thought it was important to hear from Peter this afternoon. Peter, welcome to Inside Track.
Thank you, Bruce. It's wonderful to be here.
Yeah. One of the seminal events of my youth was the U.S. space program. I'm sure a lot of other people my age feel the same way. I'm old enough to recall Sputnik. I saw Echo 1 cross the dark Tucson skies as a kid with my sisters. I marveled at all of the NASA launches from Alan Shepard to Gene Cernan. You notice I've left out the shuttle. And like many, I'm here in Tucson, admired the achievements of deep space ventures that have been initiated from work at our own University of Arizona Space Lab. And I'm excited about commercial development with space applications. On July 23rd, the White House released its Deep Space Exploration Strategy, formally entitled A New Era for Space Exploration and Development, a high-level policy document that lays out both strategy and a rationale for the development of space-based industrial economy. Tell our listeners why this new study is so important.
Well, in my opinion, this is a truly major step forward. For literally decades, as long as you can remember, and what you just described for your listeners, there have been folks who have debated much larger goals of what we would want to do in space. And those larger goals have been sort of constrained down to just sort of a tepid exploration. But this is really the first full-throated articulation of a multi-generational strategy to economically develop and settle space. And while we've heard billionaires like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos talk about that, this is really the first time that this is part of U.S. policy.
So this public-private partnership, this is really also part of an important change in strategy and direction, isn't it?
Yes. You know, what we've seen is an evolving consensus that the roles between the public and private sector need to shift, and that with increased capability of the private sector, a significant part of the responsibility for space development moves to the private sector, but that there continues to be an important and strong role of the government to sort of be the first customer, the anchor customer, or the lighthouse customer to push us to new markets.
Before we get to some of the other questions, just on that public-private partnership, it seems to take the government programs a heck of a lot longer to get rolling than it does for those on the commercial side. Is that part of the attraction of doing these public-private partnerships with whether it's SpaceX or any of the others?
Certainly, there are sort of two things that happen, right? You have sort of public interest, public good things that we would like. And oftentimes, before something is profitable, it requires the government to sort of create the market. But once there is a market, or once the government is able to create a market, private industry typically can be much leaner and faster, can compete with each other to find the best way, and they don't have the same kind of many multiple stakeholders that a government agency would have that sort of slows them down with levels of oversight and compromise. So it's sort of the best of both worlds. You can accomplish an important societal purpose, and at the same time, we can get the speed. I shouldn't say just speed, right? I mean, like NASA's own internal costing said that had they done what Elon Musk did with Falcon 1, Falcon 9, and Dragon spacecraft, it would have cost them 8 to 12 times as much to do the same thing.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. Beginning with missions beyond low Earth orbit, the United States will lead. This is from the government document. The United States will lead the return of humans to the moon for long-term exploration and utilization, followed by human missions to Mars and other destinations. I'm 68 years old. How long will it take to accomplish the goal of Americans walking on Mars?
Well, I think that if this doesn't happen out of the fire in the belly that Elon Musk and his team at SpaceX have, I think we're both likely to be waiting a lot longer. Right now, there are no firm plans to land a person on Mars by the United States, and we certainly are not funded at any sort of level to do that, nor does it appear to me like that would be an efficient way of doing it. If Elon is able to make Starship work, then you and I very well might see the first people on Mars, but I think in this case it will be an entrepreneur leading it rather than the U.S. government.
You know, it sure seems that we're big on ideas and big on planning, but the last time that we had this sort of race to the moon, it was because we were challenged by the Russians. Would China or India or Japan, some other world power, potentially create a race to Mars that might instill a greater will to get this job done?
Well, in a sense, they have. So I think the Chinese are actually more serious about putting people on Mars than we are right now. It seems to me like they are pursuing a very stepwise plan. But I would also say that they've already kicked off a race, and a race that, in my opinion, has much greater consequences than the symbolic landing on Mars. You know, they've essentially kicked off an acknowledged race by the vice president for cislunar industrialization. And so what does that mean? It means that they intend to turn the moon into an economic colony of sorts, where they're going to be doing industrial scale processes to build massive satellites that they will then put in geostationary orbit to beam power back to the Earth. That's a multi-trillion dollar market. They're projecting that by 2050, Earth-Moon Special Economic Zone will be returning on the order of $10 trillion per year. So that's aside from what they're planning to do with asteroids. So what's really different than the space race that you remember growing up is that space race was really all about prestige for the rest of the world and what was the most vibrant society. But today, while that's still a component, the primary component is geoeconomic. You know, that space offers such vast wealth that the nation that is able to tap that wealth will certainly be the power for the next century.
So the space strategy talks about transforming to more resilient space architectures. What does that mean? What does that look like?
All right, so there's a second race that we haven't talked about, and that is that essentially with the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was a period in time when the United States was able to operate unchallenged in space. And in that period of time, we also got exceptionally competent at using space-based systems to tie together our military as it served as a kind of nervous system and sensory system that enabled us to sort of project global power. Well, our enemies had decades to study us and figure out that the weak point that we had not been protecting was in space. So starting around 2007, China in particular, now followed by Russia, began to develop counter space systems, anti-satellite systems, so that they could hold us at risk and make any attempt to protect our interests or our allies' interests much more costly. And so in a few years back, we started to realize that we had a very unprotected flank and that we needed to start building our satellite architectures, not just to survive space, but to be resilient in the face of somebody that was actually trying to attack them. So, you know, right now, essentially, you have very few satellites. They're large, they're not maneuverable, they were not built with onboard defenses, and they are not able to sort of shift load to others. So a more resilient system is one that's going to be proliferated in the sense that there will be many more satellites in many more orbits, much harder to get at. And then they'll be smaller, cheaper, so that each individual satellite is less costly to lose. And then there will be a number of sort of defensive capabilities that will be designed in from the start that allow us to sort of shift load, shift information throughout the architecture.
It's been said by some space experts, the next war, if you will, and I don't mean to be talking about war, we're talking about space, but on this issue of architecture, that if our satellites were taken out, we might never be able to see. We'd be blind if there was some sort of a mass threat on the United States or any of our possessions around the world. I mean, is that essentially
yes.
What would happen if they attacked our satellites?
Well, when we say blind, it's not like it's a single, you know, poke in a single eye, right? I mean, we have multiple eyes. Our allies have, you know, eyes in the sky. We have UAVs. But our space-based surveillance assets are certainly within the reach of adversary systems, and there aren't that many of them. And one of the problems is that because of the nature of satellite observation, typically you want to put them as close to the Earth as possible, and they're not always over the same spot. As the Earth rotates underneath them, they're over different spots. So, you know, one, they're very vulnerable, but secondly, if you take out one over a particular region, you're also taking it out for the entire Earth. So it threatens U.S. interests globally, and our adversaries know that. But it is. It's exactly like throwing sand in somebody's eyes right before you sucker punch them. And certainly, you know, there are existential, you know, problems where, you know, if you have an anti-satellite weapon that could threaten, for instance, our missile warning satellites or our nuclear command and control satellites, that, you know, vastly increases the possibility of a successful nuclear first strike. That may not be the most likely scenario, but it's one that the United States has to take seriously because of its very significant consequence.
Before we talk about the SpaceX mission that just ended to the ISS, go back for just a second to the way that China is looking at potentially capitalizing on a industrial sort of an operation on the moon. What exactly would that look like, Peter?
All right. Well, what you're going to see, because they've laid it out pretty well, is that in the near term, you'll start by seeing these rovers and you'll see a sample return, and then you'll see them in place, you know, some simple experiments to do 3D printing, to do additional crop growth as they've already done with their sprouting the seeds. And then eventually they're going to put human beings down with a sort of human robotic tended facility. that they'll then expand. And so, you know, first they'll expand to sort of mining the coal traps in the regolith, and then eventually they'll be doing metal production, and then they'll be shooting the metal and silicon out to geostationary orbit, where they'll start constructing these incredibly massive 10,000 metric ton satellites that capture the sun's rays and turn it into microwaves or lasers, and then beam that down to receiving stations on the Earth to basically provide 100% green energy nonstop in a way that could scale literally to all of global demand. You know, global demand even out to the end of the century is only projected to be about 55 terawatts of power, and you could put enough satellites in geostationary orbit that you could supply six times that, like 332,000 gigawatts of energy, and you would have used like less than a millionth of the mass of the moon in order to do that. But you would have captured, you know, a $21 trillion energy market on Earth. And basically, in the same way that you might worry about OPEC being able to shut down oil, or worried about, you know, the Russian pipeline into Europe being able to coerce Germany and Europe, having your hands on the key to global electricity and power would be an extremely powerful lever, as well as an extremely lucrative way to fund your society, its expansion, and its military.
You know, Peter, I can't emphasize enough the importance of what you just described. And you obviously believe this is a very important thing as well. This is news. I follow space quite a bit, and this is the first I've heard of this sort of a venture. This is that's captivating. Are we working on any sort of similar sorts of industrialization projects ourselves?
Well, I think, honestly, I give us a checkered grade. I mean, on the positive side, right, this deep space exploration and development strategy is the first time that we have overtly talked not just about a new first, but actual economic utilization and economic development. But our plans are far less developed. To my knowledge, we have no specific plans of what we're going to do industrially on the moon. I have not heard. We have two companies in the United States, startups, that would like to be doing space solar power, but, you know, they aren't getting any kind of public-private partnership help from the government today. The Pentagon, back in 2008, recommended that we start a program on space solar power, but nothing happened. Two bright lights of hope. There is an experimental program to mature the technology at Air Force Research Lab Kirtland, and then Paul Jaffe at the Naval Research Laboratory recently had a payload on the X-37B that was sort of the first custom piece of solar power satellite hardware, you know, just like small, like not even table size. But those are isolated experiments. They're not part of a broader national program. We have, you know, unfortunately, this strategy articulates nothing on space solar power, nor have I heard anything out of the Department of Energy on this. Hmm. It would be great, because our allies, you know, certainly there's interest in Japan, there's interest in the European Space Agency, there's interest in Australia. And as I said, there are at least two firms, Solarin and Mankin Space, that would like to be doing this. You know, but right now, they're just isn't an effort to stay at parity with the PRC.
Wow, that's exciting and sort of frightening all in the same sort of thought. The first SpaceX mission to the International Space Station is complete. Your scoring on its effectiveness and what it demonstrated, please?
A+. I mean, what this really, the true significance of this mission is that it showcases to the American people and our Congress the maturity of our entrepreneurial tech base, that it can do really the most demanding mission, which is to safely send humans up and back. And so, you know, we have debated really since we started our space program what we as a society wanted. Did we want kind of a copy of the Soviet socialist program where the government owned and did everything? Or did we want something, you know, that was more traditionally American, where private industry had a significant role? And not to say the government doesn't have an important and central role, but did the American people need to own that, you know, own the hardware, own the IP, design the rockets themselves? Is that really the best way to go? And there were a lot of skeptics as to whether or not space exploration was something that only superpowers could do or that U.S. companies could do. And in my view, we have firmly cemented the reality that even the most demanding mission, you know, of sending humans up and back, it can be done by private industry. And so that opens up a broad space. You know, now this opens up new potential for orbital tourism, a much larger market. It opens up possibilities for NASA to get out of the business of going to low Earth orbit. It opens up the possibility of private space stations. And from a pro-U.S. perspective, you know, we're back in the game. We are finally able to launch American astronauts from American soil on American rockets, and that's a big deal.
I'm going to ask you one question, or actually two questions, Peter. First, I'd like to hold you over past the break, and if you'd be so kind just to spend a little more time with us. Stay tuned. It's Inside Track. We'll be right back. Customers come first at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus.
What other kind of customers do you have?
So our biggest customers are actually like ranchers and people from outside of the Tucson area. They're buying a lot of square tubing. They're buying a lot of stuff for their ranch to close off fences.
We'll sell anything from 10 feet to 10,000 feet to somebody that comes in because we have new steel and surplus steel from steel mills. The reason we're able to get such good pricing on some of this stuff is, A, we sell scrap to the mill. So we have a relationship there, and then we can buy material, what they're making, bringing it back. And so we save on freight, and we have relationships for years with them. So I think that's really our niche market. We'll sell whatever you need.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday.
I'm Eb Wilkinson with Imus Wilkinson Investment Management. I don't ever want you to be dependent on government ever again. I want you to become financially independent. You will never, ever have to depend on socialist security for your survival. We are here to guide you to financial independence. That's imuswilkinson.com, 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
Welcome back to Inside Track. Our guest is retired Lieutenant Colonel Pierre Gerritsen, an independent strategy consultant who focuses on space and defense issues. He has and does serve on many groups advocating for our country's future in space research, plus space and planetary defense. But before we do, I want to go back to something you wrote last year, a piece titled The Space Force's Jupiter-Sized Problem. And I'll quote two paragraphs from the article. Just to get your thoughts on this, you wrote, military cultures matter a lot. Cultures are those positive and negative feedback loops that encourage certain thinking and behavior in society, group, or organizational, and dissuade or make taboo other thinking and behavior. The U.S. military has thus far failed to create a unique military space culture that encourages the focused thinking and behaviors required to maximize comprehensive national space power. Lots of words there. Do you believe we've begun to bridge that culture gap that you described in that article last year?
Well, I think there's still plenty that needs to be done. So, you know, getting the Space Force itself, in my view, was a transformational victory because until the American people could directly fund, interrogate, and shape its space forces, we had basically no chance. It was hidden, buried inside the Air Force and the Department of the Air Force, subject to the whims of what was good for air power, unable to develop a cadre of individuals who were bred for excellence in space power. And now we have that. Now space sits as a peer on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, able to advise Congress, able to advise the President, able to be directly funded and shaped and legislated, you know, by Congress. But now a lot has to happen internally, right? And the reality is that we have pulled apart what really was just a piece of the Air Force and a piece of the Air Force that had a long association with our ICBM force and so had this very compliance culture that did not have adequate risk-taking, that did not, you know, really have the sort of broad, you know, thinking and initiative that is required, you know, to combat the threats to the long-term future of liberty that, you know, our society will face, you know, out in the vastness of space. And so, in my opinion, what needs to happen is that this new force really needs to take a look at the space domain from with new eyes from the beginning and figure out what space needs, you know, as a domain. And that, I think, will inevitably lead them to having more navalist thinking, that, you know, rather than think of themselves as a support arm to the Air Force or the Army, to really think about their role in securing, you know, future commerce, in extending, in doing the kind of moving forward that, you know, Lewis and Clark or Arctic expeditions did in building infrastructure. And, you know, this kind of thinking about initiative, a strategic offensive to secure the key locations and positions, to always push technology to evolve beyond the satellite force, I don't think has started yet. You know, what we've seen is a beginning movement towards thinking about themselves less as sort of, you know, console operators and more as war fighters with contested systems. But to truly perform in the way that America needs it, it's going to have to take this much larger cultural shift. And I think that'll take time, and I think it'll take external pressure.
We're continuing our last segment here with Peter Gerritsen on space. You were an Air Force man. In your article, you discussed the basic ideas that Space Force should play the same role for space as the U.S. Navy does in the maritime domain, protecting civil infrastructure and providing security for expanded commerce and trade. How will we avoid, and maybe I'm simplifying this, but how will we avoid the same interagency rivalry we encountered when the Air Force was originated first, as well as military rivalry we had as our early space program was first developed?
Oh, you won't. That'll absolutely be there. But many people don't realize the tremendous upside that that brings to the American people. Where that rivalry has been dysfunctional, which is where the services actually have to collaborate in a fight, we've largely fixed that problem with the invention of combatant commands, where the services create forces and then place them forward. But in point of fact, you want rivalry, because rivalry is the only way. It's just like competition in the market, right? You really want, you know, the U.S. Air Force out there saying, no, you know, a Navy carrier, maybe that's not the best way to spend the money. I can do this way better with bombers. Or, you know, if the Navy brings something creative, or let's say that the Air Force figures out that they can shoot intercontinental ballistic missiles, you want the Navy being like, oh, man, I need to try to match that with a sub-launch ballistic missile, because that lifts all boats and provides the American taxpayer with the best systems for their dollar. And it creates this creative competition, just like in the Olympics, to make sure that, you know, we're sharp in our systems. So, you know, one of the reasons why you wanted a Space Force was because you needed more, not less, of that kind of positive competition for the best ideas, and space wasn't even at the table. Now space has a possibility to bring solutions, you know, to the American leadership and the American people and say, look, I can do this better. Maybe I can buy a bunch of SpaceX starships and I can, you know, move military airlift better, or maybe I can do things you never thought possible. And it's that kind of rivalry that really allows us to, you know, to continually move forward and not get stagnant. Now, will there be some negatives to that? Yeah, I mean, of course, it, you know, it leads to a certain amount of public theater. But in my view, having worked in the Pentagon for a decade, what we really need is much more inter-service competition, not less. It's gotten way too collegial.
Yeah, that's a great point. I'm glad you're kind of showing the opposite sort of view of the argument that sometimes you hear a lot more about. Before we conclude today, you frequently talk about planetary defense. Can you describe what you mean by that and how advanced we are and the rest of the world's powers are on planetary defense?
Yeah, so the community uses planetary defense That's a term to describe the series of actions that you take to prevent a asteroid or comet from impacting the Earth. And people have probably heard that the major theory about why the dinosaurs died out was because we had a massive asteroid impact that when it hits at this tremendous velocity, it isn't just the destruction there. It throws up all this dirt into the atmosphere, all this dust, and basically, you know, blocks out the sun such that all the plants die. And, you know, that threat has not abated. There are, you know, an astounding number of asteroids. The number of civilization killers are somewhere in just over 1,000 that are a kilometer or larger. And we know where most of them are, but we're still, you know, there are like, you know, it's like saying there's still 10 unknown serial killers in your neighborhood, right? We don't know where they are. Haven't found them yet. And then continent-sized killers and city killers, and those number in the 500,000 to 1,000,000 is what we expect their population is, and we know where less than 5% of those are. And, you know, we routinely see, you know, these very large multi-kiloton megaton explosions high in our atmosphere. We had like two last year just right over our missile warning sites in Alaska and Greenland. And they're normally high enough that they don't bother anyone, but these are small meteors that don't make it all the way down the ground. We had one in Chelyabinsk a couple of years back, which, you know, came in and they had people accusing the United States that it was a hypersonic missile test because this was over their chemical weapons factory and over their plutonium storage facility. Even a small bolide, in theory, could kick off an accidental nuclear war without adequate awareness of it. And then you've got things that could easily, you know, a 50-meter asteroid would wipe out all of New York City or all of Washington or, you know, L.A. or Phoenix, right? So we just don't know where these things are. We don't even get 24 hours, you know, notice before the smaller ones come in.
So what's the way to, besides identifying, how do we defend the Earth against such a planetary attack?
If you find them in enough time, you know, then you may have a number of different ways of going about it. So if you have an awful lot of time and it's small enough, many times these things come close to Earth and before they come around to strike on a previous orbit. And when they come close, they go through what's called a gravitational keyhole. So if you put a spacecraft up next to it and you sort of keep nudging it with the gravitational attraction just between the spacecraft, you can make it so that it might never hit Earth. But if you don't have that much time, if it's small, you might be able to just like hit it really fast with a bullet, another spacecraft in this case. But as they get larger, really you're down to, you know, detonating a nuclear weapon. Now, what you would prefer not to do is to detonate the nuclear weapon to fragment the asteroid. If you do, you need to do it just days in advance. But then like only a thousandth of the mass of the asteroid hits the disk of the Earth, but you've still got a bunch of fragments you've got to track. On the other hand, what you prefer to do is they're going in these ellipsoid orbits. And so when they're closest to the sun is when you can sort of get the gravity assist feature. And so if you can hit it with a nuke, not on it, but close to it, what happens is the heat from the nuke, you know, fries the front of the asteroid, basically causes it to off-gas like a rocket. And that actually slows the asteroid down. And so now it's in a lower orbit and it can't reach Earth its next time around. So in terms of like, where are we at? We are at a purely conceptual, you know, nobody has built any hardware. And more disturbingly, nobody has the mission, right? So this is a mission that I think is appropriate for the Space Force, that they should have a homeland defense, a defense of the United States mission. You know, certainly they come from a tradition of being able to handle nuclear weapons and having the responsibility for space situational awareness. It makes sense to me that it would be, you know, them that would be protecting the United States and our allies or the world itself from an impending asteroid. But unfortunately, that mission has not yet been assigned, despite the fact that Congress, you know, has asked multiple presidencies to make such an assignment. Mm.
Well, Peter, we're up against it, and I sure appreciate you appearing on the show today. How can our listeners keep up with you? How do they reach you?
I usually post things both on LinkedIn and on Twitter, so I'm at Garrettson Peter. on Twitter.
And that's GARRETSON, correct?
That's correct.
All right. Well, thanks for being with us. And I hope we can call upon you frequently as a contributor to the show. This was fascinating for me. I admire what you have done in your career, and I hope we can do more of these interviews on similar topics in the future.
Thank you for having me, Bruce. I had a really good time.
Good deal. Stay tuned. It's Inside Track. We'll be right back. Customers come first at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus.
A lot of the cities and the counties around have initiatives for artists. I think we're one of the premier artist suppliers for steel. First Saturday of every month, you can come down early and actually go through the scrapyard across the street. It's 7 acres of metal. You can walk through with our people and pick out what you want. It's always interesting to see what the artists have done. We've done actually a couple projects with the U of A Engineering Department and Music Department, where the engineering music students came down together. They had to pick something out of the scrap, and they had to build an instrument. And we have one of those in front of the plant. Some really cool things come out of the scrap.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Wouldn't it be great if political leaders could create that country again? Learn how to do exactly that, one family at a time, with Imus Wilkinson Investment Management. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, imuswilkinson.com, 777-1911, 777-1911.
Welcome back to Inside Track. Our guest at the end of the hour is Boris Epstein. Boris is the strategic advisor for coalitions on the Trump 2020 campaign and served in the White House as a special assistant to the president and assistant communications director for surrogate operations. He received his undergraduate degree and JD from Georgetown University. Formerly, he's been in the investment banking business. He's also an attorney. Epstein was the chief political commentator at Sinclair Broadcast Group until December 19, 2019, and has previously worked on the McCain-Palin campaign. Welcome to Inside Track, Boris. Thanks for joining us.
Bruce, thanks so much for having me. This is great. Thanks for reading off the resume. Always nice to hear. Kind of impressive when you hear it.
Yeah, yeah. So as a child, you emigrated to America from Russia, and your parents as part of the mass exodus from Russia.
Jewish refugees, that's right.
Yeah. So coming from your background, doesn't it make sense that you have been fighting for the preservation of our freedoms in America?
No doubt about it. You know, I was a child in communist Soviet Union. I saw what the remnants of the destruction of that system looked like, the heap that was left afterwards, the destruction, the rabid anti-Semitism that drove us to come to this beautiful country. And I've been fighting my whole adult life, my whole career, for the preservation of freedoms, of the Constitution, and of the true pillars of America, the greatness of America.
It occurs to me that being from the Soviet Union really does give you just a special sort of a feel for America. But Donald Trump has that same sort of feel for America, our freedoms, the way that we are striving to be that shining city on the hill. So it makes a lot of sense to me that you're also working for him.
Well, it's been an honor of a lifetime to work for the president, to get to know the president and his wonderful family, and to do all I can to get him elected in 2016 and get him reelected now in 2020. You know, this really is the most important election of all of our lifetimes, and that's not hyperbole. The choice is just so starkly clear. You know, this is not George W. Bush versus John Kerry, who are, let's be honest, 10% of each other on policies. This is Donald Trump, his strength, his belief in America, as you said, his fighting for our constitutional rights, and the far left, represented by the empty vessel that's Joe Biden.
Hmm. You just wrote an opinion piece for Newsweek on affirmative action in housing. Now, some may think this is sort of bland stuff, but actually, the Democrat Socialist Party wants to further threaten those who live in the suburbs. You started by writing, even the most harmless, innocuous-sounding words can be twisted by the federal bureaucracy to spawn sweeping ideological crusades and bring about massive upheavals in American society. Wow.
The words under the Fair Housing Act are affirmatively furthering fair housing. And it doesn't sound like much. But what the, starting with the Clinton administration and the Obama administration, they used that as a tool to beat up the suburbs. And Westchester, New York is a good example of that. The Obama administration joined a lawsuit by an activist organization against Westchester, forcing Westchester, New York, a successful suburb, to build affordable housing close to the schools, close to the parks, and actually to break their own zoning laws. So this AFFH rule, as it was called, was a cudgel against our suburbs. And thankfully, under President Trump, under our HUD secretary, it's been eliminated. And Ben Carson has done an amazing job. Dr. Ben Carson has done an amazing job in rolling back that rule and even the premise for that rule. The premise being that, if forget the actual discrimination, but the premise was if there's even a hint of hidden discrimination, that a town could be sued. But Ben Carson, under the leadership of President Trump, have gotten rid of that. So that is very important for us as Americans, and important to note that if Biden gets into office, not only is he going to put that rule back, he's going to say that any town in America which gets any money from the federal government, it could be money for roads, is subject to that rule and could be forced to break its own zoning laws and to build affordable housing closest to its most valuable assets, like schools and parks and hospitals.
And that really is, as you described it in your opinion piece, the thermonuclear bomb to drop on the suburbs, isn't it?
Of course, no question at all. And you had Senator Cory Booker is the one that's been pushing for that. Biden has already signaled that he's in favor of that, because under the AFFH rule previously, as bad as it was, the deal was that you could only be forced to build this affordable housing if you took some money from HUD. The new proposal is literally any federal money that a town takes could make itself open, exposed to these lawsuits and then being forced to build this affordable housing. In Westchester, the town was forced to recruit Section 8 housing tenants and to put them closest to, again, most valuable assets. I mean, and by the way, whether you are exposed or not was decided based on whether your town was affluent and more affluent than the median average, or if your town was more white than the median average. So the fact that we are supposed to be allowed to naturally exist in the habitat of America, and that Americans of all backgrounds, of all ethnicities, want to be affluent, want to be successful, that doesn't matter to these social experimenting Democrats. What they want is to force Americans into this radical experiment, and that's a scary thought.
It is a radical experiment, and really, it comes under the assumption that if there's more white people or there's more affluence, that necessarily there would be discrimination against people of color, doesn't it? It's almost just like the CFPB was doing against different financial institutions. There was no proof that any of this had happened, but they assumed that if somebody thought that they might be discriminated against, it had to be a law that somebody was breaking.
As a lawyer, if you break a law, there has to be intent. Here, the Democrats want to go the other way around. They want to look at the result and say, well, if the result is your town is more affluent than the median average, that means that you wanted to discriminate. Or if the result is your town is more white, more homogeneous than some median average, you meant to discriminate. That's not the case. People are absolutely free to move in and out of any town in America. That's the beauty of America, where there's opportunity, there's growth, there's a chance to get ahead, and not to have the government try to play some weird monopoly game with Americans' lives.
Hey, one last thing, maybe off topic a little bit. In an interview this week, Joe Biden was being interviewed by a friendly journalist if he would submit to a cognitive assessment, and he nearly lost his mind calling his interviewer a cocaine user. What do you make of this most recent interview fiasco with Joe Biden?
Well, the proof's on the face, right? He was asked if he took a cognitive test, and he failed the cognitive test of being able to answer the question. He called a great reporter from CBS a cocaine junkie. I mean, can you believe that? I mean, who would do that? And, you know, Errol Burnett didn't really respond I think he probably should have responded a little stronger than he did. Biden was going off on him, and the reporter was trying to move on, but Biden kept going off. And so, yeah, he likened being asked about a cognitive test, which he obviously needs, to this reporter being a cocaine junkie. So what is he suggesting about the African-American reporter? It's truly disgusting. And it goes back to Joe Biden's roots. You have to remember, this was the guy who talked about racial jungle in the 1970s, the guy who called African-American men predators in the 1990s, and who said, you ain't black if you vote for Donald Trump, just a few weeks ago. Joe Biden is a stone-cold racist.
Well, Boris, thanks very much for joining us today. Best of luck in the remaining 87 or so days until the general election. And you are a fighter, and you, just like every one of us, is wanting to win this election, return the White House into Republican hands. And thanks very much for being with us here today.
Thanks, Bruce. Thanks for all your support, and thanks for your leadership. And we're going to keep fighting and win on November 3rd.
You bet. Hey, friends, that's going to do it for us today. Thanks for joining us. This is Bruce Ash wishing you a very good afternoon. I'm proud to welcome my good friends at Tucson Iron and Metal Retail to Inside Track as an advertiser. Jamie Kipper and her staff are conservation experts. They sell round and square steel tubing, metal plate and roofing materials, as well as new and used steel, aluminum, and stainless steel to ranchers, artists, interior designers, roofers, and do-it-yourselfers, just like all of the listeners here. Tucson Iron and Metal Retail is open Monday through Fridays, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., and Saturdays, 8 a.m. to noon. Tucson Iron and Steel Retail, 701 East 36th Street. Call 520-209-1576 or go to TucsonIronRetail.com. And when you do call, mention this ad and receive an additional 10% discount on their already great prices. Customers come first at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus.
My main goal is to make everything easy for the customer, whether every decision I make in terms of business is, will this make sense for the customer? And is this make it easier for the customer to come and look at material, how the yard is organized, what material we cover, what material we offer, anything like that.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday.